Hello and welcome to the HMEB podcast. I'm your host, David Cuff, the executive editor of HME Business, your source for news, trends, and insights into the home medical equipment industry. I've just returned from MedTrade West, which was held July 12th through 14th at Phoenix, Arizona's Convention Center. And one of the highlights for me, at least, was the opportunity to host Wednesday's American Association for Home Care Update. The update marked the return of a much more interactive format with lots of opportunities for audience participation that we originally debuted at MedTrade West 2020, which feels about a million years ago, right before everything shut down for COVID. So it was great to get back to this format, and it felt like we had even more interaction. So I was really excited about that. We covered a good deal of ground during the 90 minutes of discussion, and we talked about everything from the Philips recall to Medicaid MCO plans to legislative opportunities, all sorts of stuff. And for folks who couldn't make it, I circled back with some key AA home care staff members to give you a taste of some of the top line items that they discussed and wanted to make sure that providers were thinking about. All right, bearing all that in mind, let's dive in. I'm here talking with Jay Witter. He is the Vice President of Public Policy for AA Home Care. We're sort of towards the end of day three of MedTrade West. It's been a good show. We opened up with the AA Home Care update, which was fun. HMEB got a chance to sponsor that and be part of the discussion, and I enjoyed that. Thanks a lot, Jay.
It was great, a great event. Thank you for doing it.
Oh, yeah, it was fun. One of the things that we touched on that I think might be good for the podcast is the legislative forecast. You guys have a few things in the works. Maybe you could, for the listeners, list off what you've got going.
Sure, and thanks for the opportunity. You know, last year was certainly challenging with, the pandemic, but the industry really stepped up, and because of the support and all the work that providers and manufacturers did, we made some big gains last year and got some relief. We ended the oxygen budget neutrality requirement. We got relief for non-CB areas, and so this year we're building off of those successes. There's a lot of issues going on with increased cost, supply chain issues, so we're working to increase the competitive bidding rates. You know, late last year, CMS pulled out 13 categories of items from competitive bidding, but the payment system is going to continue based on 2016. And because of the pandemic and increased cost, you know, we're looking to increase that reimbursement. We're talking to Congress about that. And doing like a 90-10% blended rate, so 90% competitive bidding rate, 10% fee schedule. And then also we're concerned about the relief that was passed last year, which was tied to the public health emergency.
Yeah.
And, you know, that public health emergency may end by the end of the year, and we're working with our champions in the Senate to possibly extend that relief, hopefully 2 years after the end of the public health emergency, because everybody here at the show we've talked to, right, has said that the increased costs are not going to stop when the public health emergency stops. They're going to carry on for, you know, at least a year or two. So we're working on that. And we're also working on the complex rehab relief for the manual accessories. CMS just announced a 90-day extension of a relief that passed a couple years ago, and we're working to make that permanent. And then I know a lot of people I've talked to on the floor today are worried about this Medicare sequestration. If Congress doesn't act this year, the sequestration could go from 2% up to 6% in 2022, which would be devastating.
Yeah, it would. Yeah. So you've got a lot queued up. I imagine you're working, you said you're working with your champions. So what happens with that? Do you then come up with legislative language that then gets attached to larger bills?
Right.
Okay, that's the strategy.
So this effort is a little bit different, because in the past we would come up with some recommended legislative language. We'd get a bill introduced. We'd work for co-sponsors. But our champions are working to actually get these initiatives signed into law. And so we're working with them on the best strategy. They're telling us that there's possible legislative vehicles in the fall, and we're determining whether the best strategy is to have a bill introduced and get co-sponsors, or just have language inserted in the bigger bill. But either approach, providers and manufacturers should still get involved. You should be contacting your members of Congress and telling them exactly what you're going through today. The increased costs, the delays, the efforts, the supply chain issues, and it's impacting everybody. It's not just competitive bidding areas. It's not just the non-CB areas. It's every aspect of the industry is being impacted by the cost of COVID.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and supply chain issues and other things that are pushing costs higher. The producer price index keeps going up. And I was looking at wholesale inventories, and I noticed that the wholesale inventories, a lot of the categories that were up, they weren't because they were getting ramped up because of consumer demand. It was like business to business wholesale stuff, and that included medical categories because prices are going up on components and everything else.
And we have a unique challenge. I mean, anybody that's purchasing anything, lumber, automobile, all costs are increasing. All the components, whether metal, wood, plastics. But the challenge we have is, providers can't pass that extra cost onto the consumer because of Medicare and Medicaid and fee schedules and with, private pay. So the only person that can, the only body that can actually increase prices to make things sustainable is either Congress or CMS. And so we're working both approaches. We're working with CMS through our regulatory efforts and then working with our champions on the Hill on legislation.
Got it. And again, it sounds like you've got some good champions and some good, typically you guys have pretty good bipartisan support. It's pretty across the board. I mean, I think post-acute healthcare is one of the least controversial/partisan bits of public policy making still happening.
That's exactly right. And thankfully our issues are still bipartisan. There's a lot of partisan issues going on in Washington.
Yeah.
And there was a concern with, that would Democrats work with Republicans or Republicans work with Democrats. But with our conversations, they're willing to work together to make the changes necessary.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's been one of the few things we can rely on politically that when it gets down to this sort of nitty gritty, weedy sort of stuff like DemiPost, policy around the DemiPost benefit, there's still people are still willing to be wonky.
Exactly.
Nobody wants to grandstand on this.
And the good thing too is this is where we're at today with our champions is because of all the work, providers and manufacturers have done over the years, building those relationships with the Hill, providing, accurate information, telling their story. And then when the pandemic, the crisis hit, we were ready to move. And then, we're taking that now to the next step and dealing with these additional price increases. So,
gotcha. So, all right. So we've made some good investments, both on the association side and on the provider stakeholder side in terms of, creating relationships, making sure that you're heard at the district level and that kind of stuff. For providers who maybe haven't been as involved but want to be involved and are looking at this sort of the queue of legislative to-do items that you listed off earlier, and they're wondering how they can help, what do they do? How do they get involved?
Sure. Well, like I said, I think the most important thing for providers, manufacturers to do is tell your story to your members of Congress. And if folks don't know, who to contact or what to say, A-Home Care is here to help out. You can check our website at ahomecare.org. We have updates constantly. We do grassroots alerts. We also have a grassroots accountability project where we're trying to get a provider manufacturer to cover every member of Congress, and that information is on our website as well. Or you can just call us. You could call me or call, staff. And if you want information about who to contact or what the message should be, please let us know, because it's vital that members of Congress and senators hear how these increases are impacting, back home. That's basically who elects them, and that's who the most powerful message is from constituents. So any way we can help out.
And the web address is
ahomecare.org.
aahomecare.org. And if they wanted to call?
Sure. 202-372-0107.
All right. Jay, thank you very much for taking some time.
David, thank you. It's a pleasure. Have a good day.
Yeah, and have a safe trip back.
Yep, you too.
All right. And now I'm talking to Kim Brummett, who's the Vice President of Regulatory Affairs for A Home Care. Kim, how you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for asking. I'm tired after a full day of show. We're recording this as Metroid West is sort of winding down, mm-hmm. and I think it was a good show.
I think it was a great show.
Yeah.
Way better than I thought it would be.
Yeah. Okay. There you go. All right. Okay. And then the AA Home Care update was fun. That had a good turnout.
I think 85 people there, so more
there
than we anticipated
at
this show.
Yeah. Okay, there you go. So we were talking during that update about one thing, and that was the recent oxygen NCD, proposed NCD,
yes,
that CMS released. And now we're in the public, so what do you guys think phase of the NCD?
Right.
You guys did some analysis of it last week and kind of came up with some points. Maybe you could kind of go through that. What are some of the things that you think might be good? What are some of the things that you might think are bad? And
First of all, I think COVID really pushed, I think, CMS to do this. We all made comments on proposals of NCD stuff in November of 2020, and so didn't really know if they would do anything. But I think the pandemic has really showed them that there are some gaps in oxygen coverage. The good things to me are acute condition coverage, not just respiratory conditions, but any condition that would affect your ability to breathe. Coverage without having to fail other treatments tried and ruled out or failed, and then getting rid of the oxygen CMN, which has been something CMS did during the pandemic, but was scheduled to be turned off at the point that the PHE is over. So I think it's a real victory. A lot of people thought it saved us maybe in audits, but at the end of the day, it didn't suffice as medical documentation. It was a claims processing tool, according to the DME Max, so it really just needed to go away.
Okay. All right. So those are two good things, or those are some good things.
Yes.
Are there bad things?
Yes.
All right.
There's always good with bad when you get something from CMS and it's a change. It follows with their proposal.
It's like an Aesop's fable.
Yeah, it totally is. It's a lot of interpretation by the DME MAC. So what happens is an NCD comes out. When it's finalized, then we have revisions to LCDs and policy articles. And that's where it gets a little tricky. So we know that the NCDs are broader in nature and LCDs are very specific. So the question is, what are the DME MACs and the medical directors going to do with this new NCD? Are they going to put in some requirements for acute conditions, for retesting perhaps, or for some other type of hoop we have to jump through to continue coverage for those patients? There was a lot of information about the inaccuracy of pulse oximetry reading in the NCD. So then are they still going to ask for those? Because it was pretty clear in the NCD that they're so variable that they shouldn't be the tool used to determine if you need oxygen. And then the biggest change, too, is that CMS made it about being able to breathe, not the oxygen saturation level of your blood. And so how do you document that, right? Doctor says you're short of breath. A lab value is objective. So what's that going to be replaced with? So we have some concerns there for sure.
Yeah, and that's a weird one on the pulse oximetry, because that pretty much is a gold standard for measuring. So for CMS to openly say that, is
scary.
Well, it's kind of scary, and it also makes you wonder what all the pulse oximetry companies are thinking. Medical professionals use them all the time.
Right.
So,
and I think that they're relative.
Here's my question. Yeah. Where is CMS like drawing this conclusion that they're, did they have any study data?
They did. They had study data and they had all kinds of information to back up the, I would say, the variance, right? So instead of saying your saturation level for oxygen today has to be 88% or below. So they're saying, okay, so if you get somebody who's got a sat level of 92, it could also be 88, that there's a variance that you can say, oh, 89, you don't qualify, you know, which is the deal. So if they really turn all of that off, which I don't know how we would even deal with that, it's such a change. I mean, it really does affect an entire industry. When you think about all those three tests patients were doing for exercise testing, when you think about, you know, it's not the pulse oximeter they stick on your finger at the doctor, but it's a real oximetry reading that's billed and paid for. So I think there's some pretty big ramifications that, you know, I haven't even really kind of thought them all through. What's going to affect our industry, you know, not just what am I going to have in my file as a supplier?
Yeah, it's really surprising. So, and then of course, like you said, the what's worse, the NCD or the LCD that results from the NCD? Yeah, that's a scary one too. Mm-hmm. So yeah, these. So your points of concern are, I think, well taken. Now this thing's open for comment.
Yes.
So what's the timetable on the on that?
So comments are due on August 1st. I know that we've already had a preliminary meeting coming up with ours. We are actually continuing to meet with CQRC and VGM. We'd like all to be on the same page in our comments. And then once that comment period ends, CMS can choose to convene a MedCAC, which is a clinical advisory committee, to further study. Although the NCD they put out is pretty thorough. I can't imagine they would go down that. It feels like they already did based on what was in the NCD.
Okay.
And so then the next step is a finalized NCD that could be published somewhere around October 1st.
So what can providers do to assist the association in its efforts?
I think just being aware, reviewing the NCD, providing information either at DME MAC council meetings to continue the discussions with the DMDs who have probably also read the NCD, and then just making sure that they pay attention to what happens, because once that NCD becomes final, then it trumps the current LCDs. And we know that the current LCD revision process can take upwards of 6 months.
Oh, geez.
So then the question is, okay, so say it's published on October 1st, October 2nd you get a referral, and say it's an acute condition or whatnot, you know, what do you have to have in your files? So I think there's going to be a period of time where it'll be a little interesting for us. But I think, you know, as scary as the changes are, or as good as the changes are, the last revision to this NCD was in 1993.
Oh, wow.
And so really to move forward to current day clinically is imperative. And so we just need to embrace that and provide feedback and hope that they listen to what the industry has to say.
Gotcha. Okay. Kim, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
All right, so I'm now, last but not least, I'm talking to Laura Willard, who's the Vice President of Payer Relations. And Laura did a great presentation during this morning's update.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was great. And one component of that was the American Rescue Plan, which introduces a considerable amount of money at the state and local level that we're hoping providers can tap into. Maybe you can tell a bit more about the American Rescue Plan and what this could potentially mean for HME providers.
Yeah, great, David. I'll be glad to. So the American Rescue Plan Act had a lot of different types of relief for various populations. But there, when we started looking through what were opportunities out there from our industry perspective, there were a couple things in there from a Medicaid perspective, and so we started evaluating these. We've been working. We took some legal opinions on this. Worked with Kara and Brown and Fortunato and Foley Hogue, and took a look at this. And basically, there's funding that's coming to the states. We started hearing back when COVID started that there was a big concern with the revenue and the budgets of the states, and that there were going to be huge cuts coming across the board. They had to, because they were losing tax revenue, those types of things. So in order to make up for that, they were going to have to take a lot of cuts. Well, that started to stabilize a little bit as we moved further into COVID. But then there were still opportunities and still problems that had occurred for the businesses and all that were in the states. And so there's $195 billion that's being given to the states. And it is basically out there to mitigate the impact of COVID, of the public health emergency.
Oh, wow.
So it's quite a few dollars going to the states, and they've broken it down, and there's an allocation of a certain amount of that is equal among the states, and then they use the unemployment rates and increases to allocate the remainder of those funds. There's also some other funds going to the local municipalities and counties that is additional funding. But we've tapped into this state funding that's available, and we've put together an argument around this. And everybody's gotten pieces of this funding. They're doing things around repaving roads and water cleaning and types of things that maybe took a back burner during COVID. So there's a lot of that going on. But from my perspective, we were there on the front lines. We actually helped manage the pandemic. We were there taking care of the patients, and definitely feel like we met the intent for that. So when we started doing some research, definitely feel like we found a way that we could potentially get some relief for providers.
Well, and that's exactly right. You know, I think things even got so far that there was some sort of acute care happening in the home mm-hmm. setting as well. So now, how do you think the industry might be able to tap into this?
Yeah, so that's interesting. We took a look at this, and we started working on this in Florida early on because they started working on it early. They knew these funds were out there, potential were coming, so we started working with the governor's office and with other legislators in the state of Florida saying, okay, can we potentially be part of this relief? And here's the reason why we think we are. So we started this early on. This was even before guidance was issued from the Treasury Department. That we started working on this template letter. So after the guidance came out, we have put together template letters, and we're working with the different state associations and their boards, state and regional associations, and we're asking for some funding to come to providers.
Okay.
And we're really leaving it up to the states to make a decision on what they're asking for, because they know their Medicaid programs, they know what's happening from a legislative standpoint way better than we do at an intimate level. So, but most states have gone in, and our template letter is basically asking for a percentage of claims increase over a one-year time frame. Most states that have asked for this have asked for a 10% increase of payments that were made for a one-year time frame. So, for example, if a provider is paid $1 million in the last year, they would get a 10% increase on that, and it would come to providers in a lump sum payment. And it would not be patient specific, it'd just be dollars that came to the providers. They would not have to do anything like they've done with the previous relief funds. It would just come to them to help mitigate the impact of what COVID did to the businesses.
Do you think the industry is going to be able to tap into this? And then if so, when might providers be in a position where they, or is this too crystal ball stuff?
It's happening now.
Oh, and okay.
Yeah, it's happening now. So we've sent in, we've worked with state associations. Right now, there's been 26 letters sent in to the governor's offices and different key legislators. And those states have already tapped in and made requests.
Oh, wow.
Every state has a different process. For example, in Georgia, you have to have a DUNS number and do a formal request. Whereas in other states, you send in to the governor's office and you work with them as they're allocating their funding. Some states, it's legislative initiatives. And some states, it's kind of a duplicate effort. So they, in Florida, they allocated $7 billion of the funds. They have $2 billion left to do, and they're going to do it legislatively in the next legislative session. So that's the big piece, finding out who to talk to, where to get the funding, and the follow-up. So we've submitted the formal request and trying to get meetings with the appropriate people to get the funding. So there's definitely opportunity there. When we met with the chief of staff in Florida of the governor's office, they definitely felt like we met the intent and the need for the funds. And so that's helpful to know.
So
helpful to know early on. So we feel pretty positive about it. it may be a little while in coming because some states may not allocate them till next year.
Okay, okay. And so in the meantime, is there anything that providers can do to kind of help let those state leaders know they are or meet this requirement?
Right. This is one of the key things that you've heard me say a million times is those state legislative relationships are important.
Okay. All
so
right.
Meetings with the budget chairs or the governor's office, any connections you have, if you start talking about this. And so if you want to find out what's happening in your state, you can reach out to AE Home Care. You can reach out to your state association. Say, hey, what did we submit? What did we do? How can I help? Who can I contact? But the more buzz we have around this for our industry, the better off we're going to be.
Got it. Got it. Okay. Well, is there anything more people out there need to know about this aid package? Or?
They're not for this piece. There is a second relief fund under the American Rescue Plan Act.
Okay.
Which is amazing to find that there's actually two opportunities within this that could come for our industry. Usually we have the one and we're working all efforts on that, but there's a second initiative going on. It was part of the American Rescue Plan Act where the states received an enhanced federal match piece. It's called the Enhanced FMAP. And so states that signed up for this could get an additional 10% from the federal government over their standard match. And the important piece of that is it's to stabilize the home and community-based services program for the Medicaid departments. I think they found during the pandemic that it was important to keep patients at home, to be able to take care of them at home. And they saw that there were some weaknesses in their program. So this is supposed to help those efforts to keep those patients in the home. A big piece of that we've evaluated, there's lots of things in there. There's a thing around the impact to small businesses, and there's a lot of DME small businesses that it's impacted. So those funds could go to help them. And there's things around PPE. Obviously, we've have PPE issues ongoing. So there's a lot of ways we meet the intent of this fund. So we did a very similar thing. We had a lot of stakeholders come together and say, what are the requests here? Because one of the big things were, you know, they could start paying for additional things they're not already paying for. So we wanted to come up with a list, and we came up with a list and came up with the key items per product line. So, I mean, we had 10 to 12 requests for every one, obviously, but we tried to narrow it down to what would have been the most impactful for our industry. What I've seen most states doing is with this funding, it cannot be, it's a year's worth of funding. So they're asking for a 1 year enhancement of their fee schedule by 10%, 5% over 2 years or 10% over 1 year. So we've got a lot of that going on as well that would be helpful. We're asking for that for going forward, even though the program started April 1st. We're trying to look at this and be smart and not ask for retroactive payments from the state Medicaid program.
All right.
So, you know, there's a lot of opportunity there as well. And that one's with the Medicaid department, the other's with the legislators.
So, how can providers stay on top of this? Just keep paying attention to what AA Home Care is doing?
Absolutely. And your state associations, we're partnering with them very closely. And we'll be putting out information. We're working on meetings with the different Medicaid departments now and really trying to push that for everyone.
Okay.
There is one main provision in that, though, that we are using for advocacy efforts for the enhanced FMAP. If they take this enhanced FMAP, they cannot reduce rates from what were in place on April 1st of this year. So that's a big piece of advocacy for us. It gives us some rate stability for the next year on our Medicaid rates that are out there. So that's an opportunity as well.
Yeah, and it's particularly at a time when you're trying to, you know, shore up Medicaid reimbursement.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much, Laura.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Oh, yeah.
Well, lots happening on the legislative front, a real give and take on the proposed oxygen NCD, and some really tantalizing aid opportunities on the state and local front. Hopefully these interviews gave you an idea of the things AA Home Care has on its radar, and of course HME Business will keep covering what the association is working on. And thanks so much to Laura and Kim and Jay for sharing their time and information and expertise. Okay, I think that's going to bring the episode to a close. Don't forget to rate and review the HME Business podcast. And please, if you haven't already, make sure to click the subscribe button so that you get every new episode. Remember, you keep listening and we'll keep posting. And if you want to stay on top of everything that's happening in the industry, make sure to check out hme-business.com. Again, that's hme-business.com. And subscribe to eSource, our weekly e-newsletter service there. And if you haven't done so, make sure to subscribe to the print magazine there as well. And I should add, if you don't want to read the Dead Tree version, that's okay. You can get a digital flipbook delivered to your email inbox, and that's a really neat and easy-to-read format. Again, that's hme-business.com. Of course, you can follow us on social media. We're at HME Business on both Facebook and Twitter, and we're now on LinkedIn as well. And if you want to follow me, I'm at Postacute News on Twitter, and I'm happy to connect on LinkedIn as well. Lastly, if you have any feedback, suggestions, or requests, don't be afraid to reach out to me. Again, that you can hit me up on Twitter at Postacute News or via email at DKO, P as in Paul, F as in Franklin, at 1105media.com. Thank you all very much for listening. We'll keep covering compelling HME business topics like a home care's legislative, regulatory, and payer relations work. But for now, goodbye until our next HMEB podcast.